And today we're going to have a public hearing on, we'll do this one first, Senate Bill 222. And I would like to call... Okay. Also, I guess since we don't have a quorum, I'm going to open this up into a subcommittee of two until we have the others come, which they should be here shortly. And I'd like to have the administrator summarize the bill. Okay. I'll wait for Senator Cruz and I'll... All right. We now have a quorum. Committee is open, and now I want to have Mr. Bacobian summarize the Senate Bill 222.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson. In front of you is a copy of Senate Bill 222. In brief, what it does is define single-family housing in relationship to housing for people with chronic mental illness. It allows care providers of residents with chronic mental illness to occupy that same community housing, and then allows the Department of Human Services to sell or otherwise dispose of this property when it's no longer deemed suitable for housing. Also, even though this is not a work session today, there are some Dash 1 amendments which you should have with you as well. These are from the department. And basically, on the amendment, on the bill, page 1, line 26, it just simply changes the definition of multiple unit residential housing from 4 to 2. You'll see that on page 1, line 26, when we do go further with the bill. Just some brief background. Current statute does limit housing options for people with severe persistent mental illness. And some community housing options may not be possible under current statute. Current statute also prohibits the department from disposing of property used as community housing that's no longer suitable for purpose. Some data from the Department of Human Services notes that there's approximately a little over 12,000 people with adults with mental health problems that need affordable housing. There's also a significant number of people who need supportive or structured housing. And there's over 2,500 people with severe and persistent mental illness in Oregon who are homeless, and about two-thirds of those are enrolled in mental health services who are at risk of homelessness. That's it, Senator.
Okay. I did open the public hearing. Is that correct? Yes. Okay. All right. We have several people who would like to testify on this bill, and I'd like to call Bob Nickel up from the department.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and that is in the Department of Human Services. We've submitted testimony in support of the bill. It's a bill that we asked to have introduced, and we've asked for a few amendments, as Mr. Bacobian has indicated. The main purpose of the bill, and I have written testimony under the bill. Rather than read through all of the written testimony, I'll just basically summarize the purpose of it, which is to give the state as many options for developing housing that would suit a variety of needs of people who have mental illnesses using the damaged trust fund. So I would just request that the committee give it due consideration. We obviously hope for a pass on this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion for Mr. Nickel? Thank you, Bob. We may refer to you a little later. The next is Bob Repine from the Home and Community Services.
Madam Chair, committee members, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I've been asked to lend my support to Senate Bill 222. We've had and we as in the sense of Department of Human Services and Department of Oregon Housing and Community Services, have built quite a consortium of effort in special needs population housing over the last few years. I've actually brought a list that the committee might find at some time of interest of the projects in the last, I think, 13 years that we have facilitated around the state, focusing on this very population. And it's a pretty extensive list. It's all around all areas of the state of Oregon and well over 1,000 units. And to say 1,000 units are not needed is obviously an understatement when you had just heard the statement before that there's probably a need of over 12,000 of these units today in the marketplace. Now, we know that our ability to meet the population needs is really coupled on the ability to work with Department of Human Services and helping define and find those families to get them in the right type of housing that meets their particular needs at that time. We've had an extensive, long-standing relationship with them on the damaged property, as that has been evolving over the last few years under the then direction of Representative Loken, who's in the audience, I might add. There were lands that were set aside in the sale of that land of that piece of parcel for this population, and with that we had pledged resources to make sure that there'd be financial opportunities to build facilities to house the chronically mentally ill within the original campus or acreage of the damaged property. So what you'll have there in the final vision of Ville de Bois is a regular community environment, but integrated with many families or individuals who have chronic mental illness, which was really kind of the theme or the intent as the damaged property was being disposed of. We know also, and I think you should be aware of the fact that in our estimation, this is one of the specialty populations, including people with disabilities, that probably have been in the housing arena, have been some of the least served in the housing component. In the years before or prior, we've had spent an extensive amount of our resources on housing people with the elderly or people of senior needs, such as assisted living facilities or care facilities. And because of the tremendous of support that I've seen with NAMI and other organizations, that there has been a real change or emphasis on special needs populations such as chronically mentally ill and people with disability. We realize also that, and you should realize that it takes a tremendous amount of our resources to house these individuals. For all practical purposes, when the housing is developed for them, there cannot be any debt on the property because the incomes that the individuals bring with them who are residents in these facilities generally will be at the federal level of subsidy of Social Security or SSI, of which a very small amount of that can be used toward their housing. So it takes a almost probably a 98% cash or finance source commitment in order to take care of this population. But it is a population that, quite frankly, deserves and should be obliged that opportunity to have those housing independents around the state. We see in our agency at least four other activities that we participate with Department of Human Services, or not just in the chronically mental housing issue, but also in alcohol and drug recovery programs. We work with them on helping with the Oxford House program, which is another sponsored ecumenical ministry housing program for people who are homeless. And so the variety of joint ventures that we have with Department of Human Services has been tremendous, and it has been within that partnership we've been able to get farther into the populations and meet more specific population needs. This is just but one more piece of helping with our population needs, defining it better for the use of the individuals who will reside in these type of homes, and integration actually in communities on a small scale, particularly in neighborhoods, is a very non-intrusive way to introduce people with the mental illness who can be used in a housed in a more of a foster environment and integrated very quickly and smoothly into the communities. So we practice this housing approach for years, and we support the modification or name change that they're requesting in this bill.
Okay. How do you go about siting houses? How would a house become eligible for this?
Madam Chair, committee members, through our process, we have a competitive process. We have a special process. We have two competitive rounds every year for funding that we have, both state funds and federal funds. We have what we call a larger round where you would have more than 50 or 60 unit apartments competing in. And we have a second round that's designed specifically for these smaller neighborhood community type of housing opportunities. they would participate in a application process, share with us the need, the wants, the cost, what the outcomes are, what they're looking to obtain or achieve with the population. They would be assessed in a competitive way against other like projects that are being submitted within the same region, scored, and then awarded appropriately based on their scoring.
Is there zoning issues, or I'm trying to think of localities who say, oh, we don't want to have a home converted into it.
Madam Chair, actually, under the way I understand, and maybe somebody in the audience will be better at this, but it was some years ago that group homes, which this would come under the heading of a group home, is a permissible use in any single-family zone within the state of Oregon, and I think it has to do with the federal interpretation of the ADA compliance requirements where you can't discriminate or separate people out in group environment settings. So I think the number can be up to as many as 5 in Oregon residents of unrelated individuals that would still fit within the single-family code ordinances of the state.
Are there questions? Yes, Senator George.
Rick, this may be a question you answer, but it's driving me crazy, so I'm going to have to have an answer to it. When I look at the summary of the bill, it says that if they dispose of these properties, which that is without the requirement to be used for chronically mentally ill, what about the proceeds? Now, on ORS 426.506, that's line 13 on page 2, will all those dollars, if those facilities are sold, go back into mental health?
Senator Montanus, with your permission, I don't know the answer to that question, but I would invite.
Yeah, let's have Bob Nickel come up.
Okay.
Good, I couldn't answer.
Again, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel. Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, the proceeds would go back to the Department of Human Services, and then we have a housing acquisition fund, and so all of the dollars then would from the sale of property would go into that, and we would reinvest that in other housing opportunities.
Follow up. Other housing opportunities for mentally ill?
Madam Chair, Senator George, exactly, yes, for mentally ill people.
Okay. Glad we got that on the record.
Good. Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I have both these gentlemen here. For Mr. Repine, I would like to know in the last 4 years, for example, how many facilities specifically for mentally ill you have been involved in, and for Bob, how big's the wait list, and if you could also factor just the wait list in general population and also at state hospital for the civil folks that could be, I mean, just to kind of get a flavor of the universe we're dealing with here and how large the problem truly is.
Madam Chair, maybe I could start while Mr. Repine counts. The Governor's Mental Health Task Force had testimony on this issue, and the best information we have is that we're about 14,000 units short of what we need for persons with mental illnesses. So despite, I think, one of the better programs in the country for developing housing, the need is massive, and we're still working to try to catch up with that.
Senator Cruz, I would best, without running it on a tape or something, using as many fingers as I have, I would say somewhere between 300 and 350 since 2000. Again, since the partnership has been established since the earlier awards that would go back as far as 1990, let's say, we put a little over 1,000 units that was specifically targeted for this population. So, again, you can see that even though the number seems plentiful, the need is easily outpacing the units that we are creating out there.
Senator Courtney?
Thank you, Chair Moses. I'm curious, in the staff report in front of us, there is a statement in the last paragraph that reads, there are about 2,522 adults with severe and persistent mental illness in Oregon who are homeless. About two-thirds of those enrolled in mental health services are at risk of homelessness. Where are they? Those that are homeless, where are they?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, some of those people are really literally on the streets. Some of them have very unstable housing. They may live with a family member for a little bit or a friend, but they don't have a secure permanent domicile. So There are a variety of places, and Mr. Repine might be able to give more detail on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, as Bob stated, we know that there's a high propensity of people who are homeless who also have chronic illnesses and other addiction problems, let's say, or join it with addiction problems. They're on the streets that were are in and out of shelters quickly or in some kind of recovery program, and they bounce back out. We have established a 10-year plan in concert with the federal government to end chronic homelessness that we can make the committee have a copy of. They'd like to see go down that road a little bit more. But it's a very aggressive plan to identify those who are chronically homeless, and those are people who I think who have been either temporarily out of housing for at least 6 months and no longer than 2 years, and there's about a significant number of people who are just under that category, which then there's a subcategory who would have people who are homeless with chronic mental illness also as part of their characteristic.
The only thing I wanted to know is, what do you mean by homeless? And in fact, you're saying a certain percentage, most of the time, they're out in the streets. That's what I'm trying to get at. I'm not trying to question your figures or how you came up with the figures. When you use the word homeless to me, it means one thing to me, and I wanted to know if it meant being homeless on the streets.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, yes, essentially it does mean that, although I would add to that that many of the people who are homeless often get picked up by the police, so at times they're in our county jail.
But that's not... Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Okay. Are there other further questions of these two gentlemen? Yes, Senator George.
Relative to the question that the Senate President asked, do you have any idea how many of these people may have, in fact, been housed by us in the past in some of our facilities that we've shut down? I mean, do we know, or do we track this population well enough to say, you know, they had a safe and secure place at one time, and now they're out on the street?
Madam Chair, Senator George, a couple of years ago, we did take a look at that. We looked in particular at programs that had been serving people who had left Amish State Hospital, because as you probably recall, we developed quite a few of those. About 95% of the people were either back in the program or had been able to move to lesser levels of care. So we were very pleased, actually. We had an independent researcher come in and look at this, so this wasn't just our document. So about 5% of the people who left the state hospitals ended up not doing very well, ended up back in the state hospital. But, you know, a 95% success rate is not bad given the kind of people that we're talking about here. These are people who would otherwise be in the state hospital on an ongoing basis. So that's not to say that there aren't people who sometimes slip out of the facilities, but it looks to me like once we get people stabilized housing, that really helps them, as long as we're able to keep them in services and not drop them from the enrollments.
Can I do a follow-up? So this population that we're talking about that are homeless, this 2,500 or more, we're talking about people who basically we've never really identified as having mental illness. They've never been in the system, or they've come into this set of circumstances, but yet we've never been able to address their needs. Is that where we are, or is it?
Madam Chair, Senator George, yeah, I think a lot of them, we've had difficulty, you know, really engaging thoroughly into treatment. So I think that tends to be the population that circulates in and out of homelessness. So I think we have challenges to make sure that we have proper kinds of outreach approaches so that we don't just let them out there and dangle without any kind of outreach to them.
Senator Morrison.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. A person is homeless, a person is acting strangely, and at what point do you diagnose whether or not it's a mental illness? Or, I mean, are we just assuming that a lot of the people who are homeless do have a mental problem, or do we actually know that? Of course they do have, but do we verify?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I think the answer to that is that we can diagnose once we get enough time with them that we can actually talk with them. That's a lot of what the county crisis services do.
Okay.
As you probably know, counties are required to have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis. Some counties have found it necessary to have 24-hour mobile outreach. There are a couple of examples of that, particularly in the larger counties. So it's at that point when a homeless person comes to the attention, for example, may break a windshield of a car and be appearing to be hearing voices or out of touch with reality, that's when the crisis services at the county mental health programs really come into play, and they have they have qualified mental health professionals who are able to assess and then go. There are also many studies that have been done around the country that give us a fairly rough guess that probably about a third to a half of the homeless have some kind of severe psychiatric problem.
Okay. May I follow up? Because that's half of the question. The other half is, once diagnosed as having a mental problem, does that diagnosis, is that registered somewhere? Is there a tracking system that follows? I mean,
Madam Chair, Senator Morris said, yes, once people become enrolled in mental health programs, we require a diagnostic assessment to be done for that to be recorded in the clinical records of the program that serves them.
Okay.
So just in follow-up with, I forget whose question, regarding diagnosing, there is then clear-cut difference between someone who is high on drugs and someone who has a mental illness. I like that clarified for the record.
Madam Chair, let me try to answer that fairly quickly. That's the area that I've actually spent a huge amount of my career working in. The fact is that people who use alcohol and drugs, particularly things like methamphetamines, but not limited to that, those kind of drugs can mimic any mental disorder there is. So it really does require a qualified person to sort out whether this is an alcohol and drug problem or a mental health problem, and often it's both. And so that's certainly one of the challenges for the system, and one of the reasons why I think it does make sense to have an integrated state system here, where we are sophisticated in assessing both alcohol and drug as well as mental health problems, so we can tease apart what the real problem might be.
Once a resident becomes approved for mental health patients to stay in, what is entailed? Who runs the show? Who oversees it? What kind of payment is there to whoever houses them? How does the system work once you have it?
Well, Madam Chair, the vast majority of adults who are enrolled in mental health services are living in relatively independent settings. In fact, in other words, it's very a small number of people who are actually in 24-hour residential care. If they are in 24-hour residential care, group homes, residential treatment homes, adult foster care, those programs then are each one of them is required to have at least a half-time administrator who's responsible for keeping records and making sure that people get what they're needing in terms of their basic needs, their medications, and also case management services are overlaid on all of that to make sure that people are getting the full range of services that they need.
Are you aware of homes that have wanted to meet this criteria and just haven't been because of statute?
Madam Chair, the counties all work very carefully with providers in their community, and so there may be times when someone wants to operate a program and has difficulty getting themselves into the position. That could be that they need to meet requirements that we have that are written in administrative rule. It could be that sometimes the funding is not available to fund the home that the person wants to run. But I think, by and large, the counties, again, are the key organizer of the local mental health services. And it's through the local mental health authorities that people would need to approach if they wanted to operate a facility. There are occasions when people badly want to run a program for one reason or another. We don't have the money, or they can't meet the licensing requirements. So there probably are examples out there of people who want to do this who we haven't been able to find a way to get them into the business. But for the most part, we're actually very interested in talking to people who want to run these kind of programs.
Madam Chair, I'd also add the way we see these, they come in a variety of different configurations. They come from very small group homes, three, four-bed facilities, to 18 or 24 units for this target population, even to the extent where we're now starting to see some larger developments take on some subsets of their units to this population. So you're kind of getting more of an integration, so you're not just stereotype setting people into certain housing environments. So they come to us in a variety of different ways. As for our application process, they have to demonstrate to us that they have full services for the residents, that they can offer not only the services direct, but also indirect services like learning opportunities. So there isn't just not a place to live, but there are really opportunities to live and be be taking the best advantage of your time as you're in that community and in that housing. So it's self-improvement. The programs are also included in our programs. So it's a combination. You'll see a variety of different approaches at it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the implication of rising liability insurance for people who run?
Senator, from the I don't know so much about people who run them, but I can tell you that the rising costs of liability insurance for the mere construction of the development has been running up almost three times what it has been over the last few years. If you can get the insurance for the construction of the development, so those are all added costs that to this population. Again, as I mentioned before, their income doesn't change. It's a pretty fixed income, and it's only a percentage thereof of that income that they have to pay. So that means the increased cost for via insurance or whatever it might be gets then causes more resources to be put toward the development cost of the project, which means we don't do as many projects.
Well, I guess I wanted to address my question to Bob in terms of the liability of the person who runs the facility, and I do have a constituent who has complained about this for the last three sessions, and I don't know if anything's being done.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, yes, it is an emerging problem, and there are providers who are struggling to purchase liability insurance. The department has been looking at several different options and programs for that, and I can get you a more detailed report on where we're at.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I'll leave this list over here for you.
Okay. Let's call Frank Moore from the Association of County Mental Health Centers, and Doris Cameron from NAMI. Cameron Minard? Menard. National Association of Mental Illness.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Frank Moore. I'm a mental health director and a member of the committee that advises the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services on the Community Mental Health Housing Trust Fund. And I'm also here as a member of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I've passed out copies of my testimony, so I'm not going to go through it in detail. But suffice to say that there was a study done in California, not that we should always look to California for advice, but it was commissioned by then-Governor Gray Davis, which took a look at integrated treatment services along with housing for persons with that are homeless and mentally ill. And some of the statistics in the report are, to me, just quite amazing. Number of days of psychiatric hospitalization since enrollment in the program, which is about a two-year enrollment, dropped 55.8%. Numbers of days of incarceration dropped 72.1%. And you can see the rest of the data there. I think that the changes in the statute envisioned by Senate Bill 222 will allow the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, coupled with Housing and Community Services, to much more proactively and aggressively get people with mental illness back out into the communities where they belong. Also, with respect to a previously asked question, how people within homeless shelters are identified, with the help of Mr. Repine's office and Mr. Nichols' office, we've been working in Linn County on the renovation of a homeless shelter, which doubles our capacity, which also includes mental health staff from the homeless shelter coupled with staff from Linn County Mental Health Department who will actually be going in providing not only diagnostic services but treatment services for persons within the homeless shelter. With that, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
Senator Joyce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Moore, this 72.1% reduction incarceration rate, we can pretty well establish what kind of dollars those are. Has anybody rebuilt that in the equation to see, you know, if it, in fact you have that kind of reduction? That's massive savings for the criminal justice system. Has anybody ever calculated that in as far as, you know, balancing this whole effort?
Madam Chair, Senator George, to my knowledge, I don't know of any hard figures. I think we've kind of had some anecdotal speculation about cost shifts, and Mr. Nichol might have more information on that.
He is. Senator Courtney.
Yes, thank you, Chair Moore. Can I just pick up on that? I was found that...
We'll ask Mr. Nichol to come on up, too.
I found that number of days incarceration dropped by 70%. That seems to be mixing. I'm always struggling with mixing the world of mental health and the world of corrections. That statement is a statement involving corrections, right? That we, the individuals that would be in a state prison or in a county facility or something like that. Is that what that statement is referring to?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I believe in this study, and I can speak anecdotally for Linn County, those are the people who are lodged in county jails. So the number of days of incarceration, I believe in this study, is specifically related to local jails, not to Department of Corrections, which would be persons who are...
But they're in the criminal justice system, otherwise, or not? I mean, otherwise...
They are definitely in the criminal justice system.
So, but you're saying they're mentally ill. I'm just trying to relate to a psychiatric security review board, where we look at people as patients and clients versus felons. So they haven't been diagnosed as having mental illness, or they wouldn't be in a correctional facility. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, not completely. There's actually two populations, and I can speak for the Linn County Jail. We have a number of people within Linn County Jail right now who come in for usually misdemeanor offenses, who are lodged in the jail.
Right.
We do have staff there to diagnose and do treatment, but they also still have criminal charges. Sometimes they get caught up, and again, Mr. Nickel can probably speak more succinctly to it. Some of them also get caught up en route to the Psychiatric Security Review Board system, where there's been an aid and request for an aid and assist eval through the statute 161-370 or 365, where they will stay in the jail for a period of time while we're either awaiting them going to the forensic unit at the hospital for an aid and assist eval, or there is the discretion within the statute which allows that evaluation to take place on a local basis. But if it does take place on a local basis, we don't have the time limits. Good example is I've got one person who's sitting in the Linn County Jail where the option was to go for the local evaluation, who's been in the Linn County Jail now for over 3 months waiting for a local psychologist or psychiatrist to do the aid and assist eval. So people do get stuck at a local level, and we do continue to provide treatment, but obviously that's not the place to provide it.
Thank you, Chair Monson.
Did you want to respond to Senator George's
Madam Chair, Senator George, yes, I did want to tell you about a study that I'm aware of in California, again, that was done in about 2003, in which they looked at what happened when they provided outreach mental health services. They showed decrease in arrests, decrease in number of days in jail, decrease days spent in hospitals, and decreased time spent homeless, increased days spent in, obviously, in housing, and increases in employment, competitive employment, and they took it further, and they did quantify that in terms of the kind of cost savings. Now, one can always quibble about the assumptions, but there was a very, I think, a bona fide attempt to quantify some of these things in terms of the sort of savings that you could expect. And if the committee would like, I would be happy to get a copy of that to the administrator.
Okay. Thank you. Doris Cameron?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have submitted some written testimony, so I'll make my comments briefly, very brief. My name is Doris Cameron Menard. I'm a board member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Oregon, and I also serve on the Villebois Housing Committee. And I'm here to provide support for the testimony for the support of Senate Bill 222. Two NAMI members, Representative Crummell and then Representative Jane Loken, were instrumental in getting past House Bill 3446, which created the Housing Trust Fund and the sites on the damaged hospital grounds. I have served on the Villebois Housing Committee since it was established, and I support the changes in the definitions that this bill will clarify. I think I can speak for family members and tell you how important it is to have housing for persons with mental illness. And for those persons themselves, it's very important to have a place, a room, or a part of a room to call your own. My own son shares a room with two other young men, and the very few feet surrounding his single bed is his private space. So this bill and housing are so critically important, and I urge your support of this, because this is going to really help define and clarify the kinds of housing that can be developed. It will provide a wide array of housing to meet a wide array of needs and really fulfills the spirit of the Olmstead Act. So thank you for your support, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Jane Loken is actually here, former legislator from Clackamas County.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm not displaying a new form of footwear, but the doctor says I have to keep it on for a while. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here today to provide a little testimony on this bill. I worked to get the damage bill, as I refer to it, through in 1977. And finally...
Could you please identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, Jane Moulton from Clackamas County, former state representative. And I did... we had good bipartisan support for the bill in 99, and it passed. And as the chief sponsor, I have been very aware of what's been going ever since then, watching carefully. And it has bothered me sometimes because I've seen some runs on the fund, and so many times all of these other areas are and needs are good too, but when you've dealt with mental health, you recognize the priorities. And my interest is, of course, deeply rooted because our oldest son has been a victim of schizophrenia for many, many years, since his youth. And he's been assigned at various times to jails, Burnside housing, if you want to call it that, quote-unquote, foster homes, damage, the Oregon Mental Health Hospital, and finally to a secure housing facility in Portland, which houses 16 chronically mentally ill patients who have excellent care. This latter housing has been by far the most beneficial setting for Ron. He will never be normal, nor will he ever be able to handle his own needs. And we, as parents, so often parents cannot provide that need either. Ron is the type of mentally ill person that we had in mind in drafting House Bill 3446. And yes, very closely with several NAMI people and with Representative Crummell. There are thousands that need this kind of care. And I've watched, as I said, watched this carefully because I would like to see this bill really materialize into substantive, consistent housing funding for the mentally ill. We're in such a situation where we are wondering all the time. We face this problem. Well, what are we going to do with our mentally ill? Where do we keep them? Where do we put them? That was my concern in starting to think about this bill. Damage Hospital was built to house the mentally ill. That's the population it should continue to serve from the money. Today, I do have a few concerns, and I am totally in favor of the bill, but I really just have a couple of concerns, and I'd just like you to think about it, and those who are concerned with it. I know Mr. Refine is certainly very knowledgeable on this, and I would certainly defer to his knowledge in providing housing needs. But single-family housing for three mentally ill persons also in this bill includes housing for care providers. To me, I have a little concern about what is a care provider. And I'll go into that a little bit, concern in a little bit. But the first bill, House Bill 3446, was designed to accommodate multiple unit residential housing because we wanted to get as many people being served as possible by the funds from this trust fund. And if we thought that if we had larger units that would house more people, who would reach more people and possibly build more cost efficient. I don't know that for sure, but I raise that concern and that question. And again, I think there are people in this room who probably could supply that answer and put my mind at ease. Because I would think the priority should be on FAIR, the type of housing that will bring the most benefit and provide the most people, care for the most people in the most cost-efficient way. And then, as care provider, I would like to see in the bill a definition for care provider. There have been, in some of the committee discussions, there was pretty loose as to what a care provider was. And that concerned me. I think that if we spoke, I heard mention of foster homes. I know there's many different needs for foster homes. It seems to me often that a foster home is owned by a family or by an individual, and so they rent out space in their home for clients and bring in a care provider. I think, or bring in sometimes mentally ill, sometimes not mentally ill, just sometimes people who just need, they're ill and they need help that way. We need to focus on mentally ill. And but also in a single family home, you often have a husband who is working or not working, whichever the case may be, or a wife. You may have children. You may have a grandparent. My concern is, are we taking space? If we make this too open for care providers, that we take away space for mentally ill. That is a concern. So I hope the committee will think about that a little bit. If we could get a good description or maybe a little more clear description of what a care provider is for the bill, I think that I would feel more comfortable about it. But it's just my dearest hope that we work together and bring about means of spreading that money from the trust fund in the best possible way to treat the most people. So these are concerns I'm raising. I'm with you all the way and doing what you can to get this bill passed. So, and in the best way for all of our people that need it so badly. Thank you very much.
And thank you. And I think that Mr. Nickel can respond to a couple of your concerns right now.
Excuse me, may I make one more comment? That was on the where the money goes. I noticed I had that question as well. And I talked to Vicki Scria about it and also the Legislative Council on ORS 426506, because it says that the proceeds will go back in to that statute description. And it's supposed to be, as I understand it, then the Community Mental Health Housing Fund that goes back into.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and former Representative Loken, I really do appreciate the concerns you've raised, and I think there are ways that we can deal with those. First, I did want to comment that one of the most cost-effective ways of moving people out of the state... Bob Nickel, Administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. One of the most effective, cost-effective ways of moving people out of the state hospital has been to move them into adult foster homes. So although it probably wouldn't serve as many people per amount of money, it, for some people, that's really the only way they're going to get out of the state hospital. And it actually is one of the least expensive ways of doing that, moving people into 24-hour care. So that's one reason we wanted to make sure that the change in the statute included that as an option, so that we could at least do that when we had that opportunity. As far as the definition of a care provider, we recognize, too, that that's an important issue. I believe when we were working on this with Legislative Council, we were advised to deal with that through the administrative rule process, and that is our full intent to deal with that concern that you're raising there. And I think you you've captured the name of the housing fund that we have in our office. So I think those are the responses I wanted to make.
Thank you. Thank you both. Oh, Senator George.
Jane, I'm kind of with you. I'm a little uneasy about this bill. In line 7 on page 1, it says the community housing means property-related equipment that could that are used or could be used for chronically mentally ill. And then we go through the description down to line 9, and it says that then it removes occupied by chronically mental ill. Is there any reason not to leave that in there so we're being very clear in the bill that this is for the purpose of benefiting chronically mentally ill? Or am I just unduly paranoid here?
Madam Chair, Senator George, could you direct me again to the...
Okay, line 7, it has said or could be used for. In other words, there's a question there as to whether it might be used for something else, but then we strike out down on line 9, we remove, correct, I'm reading this right, we remove occupied only chronically ill.
I'd point out that if you're going to include care providers, you have to exclude that. That's, I mean, you can't do one without the other. I mean, because we're including care providers.
Right.
So if it also said at the same time that it could be occupied only by chronically mentally ill persons, then it wouldn't include care providers.
But why not say and their providers? And their care providers?
Well, I think, we aren't in
okay.
We aren't in one session.
Yeah.
The intent... That was why it was excluded. Is
Madam Chair, Senator George, yes, the intent is clearly, as you're describing it, is simply a matter of whether this is maybe the best wording, and obviously in a work session you can work that through. But the clear intent is that we reserve this kind of housing for people with chronic mental illnesses. And on those occasions when it makes sense to have a care provider living on premises, like in an adult foster home, this would allow that to happen. But the full intent is that this is housing for people with major mental illnesses.
Okay, thank you. Any other further discussion? I do want to, for the record, we received a letter from Clackamas County Department of Human Services from Irene Fisher Davidson. I know she was here earlier, but I saw that she stepped out, endorsing, supporting Senate Bill 222, and that is entered into the record and is at each of your places. Okay. All right. If there's no further discussion, I would like to end our public hearing on Senate Bill 222. It is on the agenda for public hearing and possible work session for Wednesday, January 26th. I would now like to open the informational hearing on mental health parity, and this is an issue that has been discussed over many, many years, and I hope that we're going to be able to at least do something regarding that issue. And I've invited Irene, Aaron, Kelly Seal from the Office of the Governor to come start this out.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Steele, and I am an advisor to the governor. I advise him on issues relating to health and human services. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. You may also know, based on the testimony that you had last week, that I also was the co-chair of the governor's interim mental health task force, and that group's report, which I think you all have had access to and some discussion about last week, included 10 systemic findings and one and over 50 recommendations designed to address them. And one of the systemic findings related directly to this issue of mental health parity. And the term mental health parity refers generally to insurance coverage for mental health or chemical dependency services that is subject to the same benefits as and restrictions as coverage for other physical health related services. So parity is really talking about the world of insurance and what insurance carriers are required to provide or not provide with respect to mental health or chemical dependency services. The finding, just to remind you, in the mental health task force relating to parity said this, that Oregon is among a handful of states that does not require significant parity of private insurance for mental health conditions. This failure has two major consequences. First, it results in a substantial shift of costs from the private sector to the public sector. Second, it means that families who are otherwise insured but required to cover mental health treatment costs from their own pockets fall into poverty needlessly and at great cost to society, far exceeding the cost of treatment. That finding resulted in a recommendation from the group that the governor's office, together with the legislature, work to create a reasonable mental health parity solution for Oregon by way of adopting legislation requiring private insurers to provide parity coverage for mental illness and substance abuse services. And this morning, we called together a group of folks to begin to have that discussion, to try to figure out whether we could build some consensus around a reasonable mental health parity solution for the state. I brought, and I'll hand out to you just a list of the people who attended, and there were a few who were invited to attend who weren't able to be there because the meeting was scheduled prior to your committee meet hearings being scheduled. So you can see, though, from this list that we attempted to have a very broad cross-section of interest represented so that we could bring those divergent perspectives that exist and that you'll hear from ultimately should you consider legislation around the issue of mental health parity into a room to try to have the conversation before they're here, before you testify. So my purpose this morning with the group was really to do a couple of things. One was to instill a sense of purpose, which I've already described, and then two, to instill a sense of urgency, because I have spoken with you, Madam Chair, about the considerable interest that you have in moving the issue forward. And so to do that, we focused on three things this morning. The first was really to try to develop a foundation of information and common understanding around what we do and do not know. The second was to really, I think, get a have a better understanding of each other's different perspectives, where representatives from the business community, the insurance community, the provider community, the consumer community are coming from in Oregon with respect to the issue of mental health parity. And then thirdly, we wanted to identify issues. We spent quite a bit of time actually identifying issues that we need to know more about. I had asked the group to take a look at last session's Senate Bill 1 as a starting point for discussion and talk about what they supported about that legislation, what they'd like to have seen look different in the legislation, and then some of the barriers that may or may not exist to the passage of mental health parity going forward this session. And the group really identified a myriad of issues. I can tell you I've got a lot of work before me that we need to learn more about and bring back to them for their consideration, information about the impact on an individual, the information about the cost of parity, and especially as that relates to impacts for the ability of the public sector, the private sector, and individual to have health insurance coverage, period. So that was a big topic of discussion this morning. So in terms of next steps, we've got a lot of work to do. We've asked folks who participated to be candid and forthcoming with information that they have that they may be giving to you later on, and I'm confident that they'll do that. We'll be looking at a lot of information ourselves as well as staff. And the next meeting, I think we're going to take a look at that information and based on it really start working toward that solution and hopefully be able to come back to you in the relatively near future with some sense of where people are and what they can agree to or not. So that's my goal.
What's your time frame regarding how many times you're going to meet and when you could come up with a recommendation?
Well, I told the group this morning that I think we need to set a limit on for ourselves and our work, because this is certainly a very complex issue and we could talk about it for quite a while, but we discussed this morning 3 to 4 weeks having some conclusion to the work that we're doing so that we can bring something back to you.
I think that I know there is one bill that's already been introduced, and I think there's a second bill also. So if you could relay to the committee that there are two bills, and then whatever recommendation that we can, if need be, could look at incorporating any of their ideas if it's more, if it's better than what the bills that are being introduced have in them.
So, I will do that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Because the last day for the Senate to drop any bill is February 2nd. So at least from this side. And that is next week. Yes. And the House is March, I'm not sure. A little bit, a few weeks later. All right. Thank you very much, and we'll be in touch. I'd like to call Mike Becker from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon and Kathy Loretz from the Public Employees Benefit Board, if you could, two could come up together. And we can start with Mike Becker first.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I work in the area of public policy for the Oregon Plan. I'd like to thank you for inviting us here today to be participating in this testimony. And just for the record, Regents has been an active participant in the discussions regarding mental health parity going back, I believe, at least 6 years. And we were very involved in the last session as well. Regents recognizes that behavioral health is an important part of the overall health and well-being of our members, and that untreated mental illness can result in a significant cost to society. We believe health plans play an important role in providing access to coverage for mental illness. Comprehensive insurance benefits for medical and behavioral illness is desirable. However, benefit expansion does come with a cost. It's a trade-off between premium and the expansion of benefits. As costs rise, as premium costs rise, invariably some people, some groups, will choose to no longer provide coverage at all for their individuals. Health insurance coverage must remain affordable for as many purchasers as possible. Just last week, there was a report released by the state that indicated that the cost of insurance was the most frequent factor cited in being uninsured, why someone had dropped coverage and was now uninsured. Expanding mental health and chemical dependency benefits to full parity will better meet the needs of a segment of our society. However, many chronically mentally ill patients are not insured at all in the commercial group market, and they will not benefit by this change. It's also important to keep in mind that a parity benefit along the lines of what was proposed last session of Senate Bill 1 does not address parity or mental health or chemical dependency in the individual market, nor does it touch ERISA self-funded groups. Expanding behavioral health coverage does come at a cost, as I have mentioned. And Regents has a unique experience in providing insurance and benefits for two large groups in the state who have elected to go with full parity, aligning their mental health benefits and chemical dependency benefits with the physical health benefits. And what I'd like to draw your attention to today are the charts that you've been handed. And there are two sets of charts. The first set has to do with mental health utilization rates, both for what I will call the control group on the top of the page, and those are Regents group employers that have the current state mandate for mental health benefits. On the bottom of the page, you will see the experience for two Regents groups that have gone to a full mental health parity benefit. And you will see the difference in the utilization between those two groups, the control group and the parity group. Both of those groups' utilization tracks pretty close with one exception, and that is in the area of outpatient care. And you will notice in both years 2003 and 2004, there is about a 60% higher rate of utilization of outpatient benefit services in the parity group compared to the control group. You'll also notice, you won't see it on the chart, but our actuaries tell me that the cost of that increased utilization is about $5 per member per month in actual claims cost for the parity group compared to the control group. And keep in mind that when I say per member per month cost, I am not talking premium cost. This is in claims cost and utilization for those health benefits on mental health. The second chart that you will see in your packet is essentially the same data presented for chemical dependency benefits for the control group and for those groups that have gone to a full parity benefit here in Oregon. And again, you will see the increase in utilization in outpatient care for those benefits as well. Note also that when we refer to these groups that have gone to the parity benefit in Oregon, that we're talking about groups that allow care management tools in the mental health and chemical dependency side of the same nature as are used on traditional health benefits, physical health benefits. And without those medical management tools, those care management tools, the utilization that's reflected in these charts, we believe, would be much higher. The second set of charts I'd like to draw your attention to in the packet has to do with the existing state mandate. And this shows the number of Regents enrollees, group enrollees with the existing state mandate, the number who access their benefits in that mandate, and the number of our members who have exhausted those benefits. And the first chart in that series shows mental health. The second chart shows chemical dependency benefits. What you will see, as reflected in the notes at the bottom of the page, is that the number who exhaust benefits, both on the mental health side and the chemical dependency side in Oregon under the existing mandate, is rather tiny. 1,000 per 1,000 enrollees on the mental health side, 1.3 adults will exhaust benefits in the region's experience, and 1.6 children will exhaust benefits per 1,000. On chemical dependency, the numbers are 0.6 for adults exhausting those benefits and 0.3 for children exhausting chemical dependency benefits, again, in the region's experience. Again, we believe that mental health treatment is an important part of the overall health and well-being of our members. At the same time, we are conscious of the need to keep premium costs and insurance as affordable as possible to all of our members and all Oregonians. Imposing new benefits benefit mandates invariably results in some groups or individuals dropping coverage, and it is this trade-off that is the key policy consideration for the legislature and for the state. If this legislature determines that the collective good of Oregonians requires comprehensive parity between behavioral health and physical health benefits, then we would ask that carriers be given the same care management tools for behavioral health as they are given for physical health benefits. And that is how we can help manage the costs of this benefit expansion. Finally, Regents, as I mentioned, has been actively engaged in these discussions. We continue to intend to do so and want to be a part of this, finding a workable solution for this very complex issue. If you have any questions, I will answer them. Thank you.
Senator George.
Mr. Becker, is the population that we have in front of us right here, would this reflect the general population, or would you suspect that the population, the two groups that were chosen, might in fact have lesser problems, say, with mental illness or chemical dependency? Is it, or do you think it's a representative sample?
We did not select the groups out of any broader group of, or any broader category. The two groups that in the parity group are the only two groups that we have in the state, the state of Oregon, with parity type benefits.
So these are state employees? Is that?
That,
be careful
that would
with that.
Be a very good guess.
All right. My guess would be that their demand would be less than, say, the general population as far as in these areas because of income and other social factors. I mean, maybe I'm just overestimating what I believe the impact is. Do you think it would be reflected, or do we have numbers from other states who have put in these kind of requirements as to what the real costs are?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I believe as I understand the data and the discussions with our actuaries, it is just the opposite, that there is a higher degree of utilization of these benefits on the part of the employees reflected in what I call the parity groups. And there is another group in there beyond the state.
I would like to know in this study, how do you have a breakdown? I know there's a wide range of diagnoses, mental health diagnoses, from schizophrenia or bipolar to depression. And I was wondering, would you be able to know how many claims were made regarding depression versus, say, bipolar, just to sort of get a sense with where is the greatest who are the users, or what diagnoses are most commonly used?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have not seen that particular breakout for this period of time reflected in these charts. I believe we could have our actuaries extract from the data that specific subcategory of which diagnoses are reflected in these various categories of utilization. And I have seen that type of data for an earlier period of time, but it might be prior to parity for these parity groups.
Okay. I think that would be very useful information for since cost is obviously a real big significant factor in the state of Oregon right now, as well as cost of insurance premiums. So I would just like to have that information available.
Madam Chair, we will obviously have to consult with the groups that
if it's possible.
Is their data. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. When you're talking about management tools here, obviously your management tools would be things like restricting number of visits and things like that. I'm not quite sure how else you'd get there. So obviously it's some sort of formulary as to what's available and what qualifies as a diagnosis, I'm assuming. So, because the fact is, one of the things we've dealt with in trying to reach parity here is if it's open-ended, you know, it goes on forever, and that's one of the issues we talk about. So I guess kind of a snapshot, and I realize we're dealing with proprietary information here in some cases, and not everything's accessible. But if we kind of had a snapshot of the sort of formulary we're working under here, might be helpful.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, just briefly, the types of care management tools that I was referring to, some of them include such things as case management, prior authorization, utilization management, that sort of thing.
Thank you. Ms. Loretz?
Thank you, Chairman Monsanderson, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Loretz. I'm the Director of Operations with the Public Employees Benefit Board. You have in front of you a PowerPoint presentation that has some information about our experience with parity with Regents. It focuses only on the state employees that do have coverage through Regents. The Kaiser members have full parity, and the cost of that parity is embedded within the premium, so we don't track that data. But we do track it with Regents. Back in 2002, mental health benefits for the state of Oregon were limited. Regents members had 52 visits for outpatient services for adults and children. They had 19 days for residential for adults and 20 days for children for residential. And an inpatient, they had 15 days for inpatient and 16 days for adults and 16 days inpatient for children. We use those benefits in the comparison and the reconciliation that we've been doing for the cost of the parity that we have in place now. So then in 2003, we implemented parity with Regents. And in our parity program, there is unlimited outpatient visits for adults and children. there's a limit of 45 days for residential care in a 12-month period. The benefits I gave you before were a 24-month period, so this is quite an going to 45 days per 12 months is quite an improvement for residential care. And then we have unlimited benefits for inpatient care for adults and children as well now with Regents. We do have management controls on the program. We have, for outpatient, a treatment plan must be filed with Reliance Behavioral Network, who is the vendor that manages the mental health benefits for Regents. So for outpatient, the management tool that is used is a treatment plan has to be filed after 8 visits. For residential care, a prior authorization is required. And also prior authorization is required for inpatient. They also have available case management, which utilizes nurses for coordination of care along a whole continuum of services. The agreement that we have with Regents is the state of Oregon pre-funded the parity at 1% of our premiums. That's an estimated cost that Regents and the state decided would... Maybe that's what the cost of parity would be. So for 2003, we paid an additional 1% to Regency throughout the year. At the end of 2003, actually it took a little bit longer than that for claims run out, Regents made a determination of the cost of claims that were above the 2002 benefit level. That is, they looked at the cost of claims of anything that was above the pre-parity level. And then we compared the cost of those claims with the costs of the 1%. And the bottom line on that is that the cost of the 2003 mental health parity was a little over $1 million, which is about 0.42% of our total 2003 premiums. The prepaid premium that we paid was about $2.5 million, and so we will be getting a refund from Regents of $1.4 million. We found that some of the real important points that we'd like to take forward regarding mental health parity is particularly looking at our data and our experience. Well, first of all, we are continuing this, and we continued it in 2004 and 2005, the same agreement. All of the benefits are based on a 24-month clock, and each individual member in the state of Oregon has their own personal clock. When you access care, your 24-month clock begins then. So it's really difficult looking at the data to know which way we're going to go because there's not a set benefit plan for everybody. So when looking at the data, you have to remember that it's a little bit fluid. It's also important to remember that 1 year doesn't make a trend. We're anxious to look at what the 2004 data looks like to see whether or not the costs have gone up or down. It's also important to remember that when the 2002 benefits that we're using as our baseline were above the state-mandated benefits, so it's a richer benefit package than maybe other employers might have. And again, we do have the management tools in place that do help control some costs that we have. And okay, I entertain questions.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. Is this a common practice when you add something to Regents that you pay extra and then see how much it's going to cost and get a refund? Is that something that is part of the negotiation of the cost of insurance? I can understand it being for certain areas. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, this is the only instance of this that I'm aware of. I've only been there a year, but all the other benefits are negotiated as a whole.
Could you answer that question?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's my understanding as well. That, and I believe the impetus for this change was as a result of PEB proposing a benefit that was beyond the state mandate.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Bacobian.
Thank you, Chair. Do we track, do we know the number of people are, in terms of either grievances or consumer satisfaction, in terms of using the mental health benefits, especially the management tools? I mean, are people generally satisfied with the system, or do we even track that?
Madam Chair, Rick, we have our customer service, and Regents does as well. I don't have that information. I could get some anecdotal information if you'd like that. I'm sure that there is some.
No further questions? Okay, Senator George?
No.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. And let's call Becky Childs from Consumer Survivors, I believe, and Angela Kimball from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Becky Childs. I'm a consumer survivor. In case you don't know what that is, that's someone who's used mental health services, and I have a psychiatric disability. The people that I represent are split when it comes to parity. I just, the conversation went a different direction in my head. Anyway, they are split. There are a number of people who are for parity, and there are a number of people who are against parity. I myself am for parity under certain conditions, and that is that when the state exercises its powers to simply commit a person, that I am not in favor of parity. There needs to be a word added into the statute for voluntary services. The reason for that is my opinion that the state is going to exercise its police powers to detain me and deprive me of my civil liberties. It has an obligation to pay for that as well, and not use my personal benefits for them determining that. And generally, where you'll find this opinion amongst folks are folks who have had less than optimal treatment in mental health services and have felt either harmed or that their lives have been seriously impaired by the consequences of that treatment. The other part that I would just say is that I do advocacy for individuals with psychiatric disabilities throughout the state of Oregon, primarily in Multnomah County, but I also do around the state as well. And the folks that I work with, a good number of them would say that they are for choice, and that when you go to the hospital for any other condition, you can choose to refuse that service. In mental health, that is the only condition that you don't have a choice, that somebody can take that choice away from you. And so that would be my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball, and I am here to represent the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Oregon. Although, just to clarify matters or muddy them, I work with Gina Furman with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. But today, I am here to represent all the families of NAMI. And I want to remind the committee that a year and a half ago, a 14-year-old boy came to this building of his own accord to speak about mental health and substance abuse parity. And when he finished speaking, 9 members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services rose to their feet and applauded. And here briefly is what that boy said. He said, "I'm here to tell you about my brother and my dad and how treatment and medications changed my family's life. Because ever since I was little, my brother went to psychologists. He was hard to deal with. He got mad at everything. He made my life miserable. But he finally went to a psychiatrist who said he had bipolar disorder. And without my brother having medication, I probably wouldn't be here right now. I know I can't live with him unless he has his meds. I'd run away. I know what he's like when he doesn't have them. And now he's okay, but his medications cost a lot. And we have to pay for his counselor visits because we don't have any more left on our insurance. And I also want to tell you about my dad. When I was young, I never really knew my dad, who he really was, because he was always on drugs except when he quit. But he always started again. He kept it very hidden, and he had a very good job. But when we found out, my mom divorced him. He lost his business and destroyed almost everything before he wanted to go into treatment again. But I know his insurance wouldn't cover it, because he had been in treatment a long time ago, and they wouldn't pay for it again. And my mom had to pay a lot on her credit card when he went in, because otherwise they wouldn't take him. I know it made her mad, but he's our dad, so she did it. And when he was in Springbrook, I went to the family week where we learned about people's addictions and all about drugs and the people who were using them and about our feelings. I learned about families and how I was the lost child. That's someone who keeps their feelings inside and worries. I used to worry all the time that my dad was killing himself, and I didn't want to think about it, but it affected me. And I used to be embarrassed when kids asked me why my dad never picked me up from school. I felt like no one in the world understood how bad it was to have a brother like Alex and a dad who was addicted. But my dad's been clean for a year. He's taking antidepressants. He's doing really well. He started up his business again, and I'm starting to have a real dad. And I think insurance should pay for things like my brother and my dad's problems because they affect the whole family. I know hundreds of stories from fellow NOMI members, but I know this story particularly well because it's the story of my youngest son, a boy he used to try to hide his tears that wet his eyes at night when I tried to kiss him goodnight. And I wish that his story was unique, but it's a story echoed by NOMI members and too many other families throughout Oregon. But thankfully, both our governor and our president echo their call for health insurance parity. Last May, our governor, in a speech, declared his commitment that every child in Oregon be safe, healthy, with adequate food and shelter. He said, "This includes my determination to make sure that there is parity in health care coverage. That means physical health and mental health must be treated the same." And our president has stated, "I share this commitment. Health plans should not be allowed to apply unfair treatment limitations or financial requirements on mental health benefits. Remarkable treatments exist, and that's good. Yet many people, too many people, remain untreated. Some end up addicted to drugs and alcohol. Some end up on the streets homeless. Others end up in our jails, our prisons, our juvenile detention facilities. In Oregon, thousands suffer from mental health and substance abuse disorders. And as the president suggested, many of those who could be successfully treated are ending up on our streets and crowding our jails and prisons rather than experiencing recovery. In fact, individuals with serious mental illness, the most severe mental illnesses, comprise almost 20% of all state prisoners, and 47% would benefit from some mental health treatment. Even more have alcohol and drug treatment problems. 73% of Oregon's inmates suffer from a moderate to severe substance abuse disorder. This impact to society is enormous. And that's why the president of the Oregon Jail Managers Association, sheriffs across Oregon, and others in the criminal justice system have joined a coalition called Partners in Crisis that support parity legislation. And businesses, too, are recognizing the impact of mental health and substance abuse disorders on the productivity of their workforce and, too, the benefits of providing better access to mental health and substance abuse treatment. Clinical depression alone costs employers $44 billion each year in lost productivity. Yet the success rate for treating clinical depression is over 80%. Bank One Corporation found that its employees lost 10 times more workdays to depressive illnesses than to either high blood pressure or diabetes. As a result, Bank One Corporation offered mental health parity and saw decreased absenteeism and relapses. Yet despite the prevalence of mental health and substance abuse disorders and the effectiveness and cost efficiency of treatment, insurance discrimination continues to exist. The Oregonian editorial in April 14th of 2003 stated very well. They remarked that as medical research continues to demonstrate links between mental and physical health, it becomes increasingly clear that trying to distinguish between them is an arbitrary distinction. That arbitrary distinction must end. And the good news is that parity comes at an incremental cost that is extraordinarily low. There are two major federal studies commissioned by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that have found that state parity laws have had a small effect on premiums. Cost increases obviously are lowest in systems with tightly managed care and generous baseline benefits. And as we've seen in our own state, in the PEB board, an increase of less than half of 1%. And also, according to federal studies, parity has not caused employers to drop coverage or switch to self-insured products. And lastly, costs not shifted from the public to the private sector with parity. In summary, I can only add that it's gratifying to discover that federal research and our own state's experience is proving what so many families have known in their hearts, that mental health and substance abuse treatment is cost-efficient. Parity can help people get the treatment they need. Parity can help families and their children stay healthy and strong.
Thank you, Ms. Kimball. Any questions? Thank you.
Okay, are there other representatives of the healthcare provider network that would want to speak on this issue? John McCauley? Hospital Association? Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCauley, representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'll make some brief comments just to let you know that our organization of the medical doctors who specialize in psychiatry do support parity. We were very strongly supportive of Senate Bill 1 of last legislative session that I think included many of the things that Mr. Becker had talked about. It included provisions for managing the benefit. It did establish the 45-day limit on residential treatment, and we believe was a good approach to take to this issue. And we would hope that any bills that are introduced this session on parity would mirror the work that was done on that bill. I also want to extend appreciation to Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield for working with us last session to develop the amendments to that bill. I don't think they support the bill necessarily, but they sure helped us put in place something that would be workable if parity were to pass. From our viewpoint, parity probably isn't even the right word to be using. We look at it more as a discrimination issue, where people who, by whatever luck of the draw, ended up with a mental disorder instead of some physical disorder, are discriminated against in getting coverage for those illnesses under group insurance plans. We would hope that the committee would look favorably on ending that discrimination should a bill come to you this session. From our standpoint, as providers of services, as physicians, it's been difficult to, I guess, deal with this issue because it, in essence, is asking, from a policy standpoint, to discriminate between the brain and other organs of the body, and to say that the conditions, some conditions of the brain, are not important to treat, or we don't consider them as important as other conditions of the brain, where you would treat certain conditions that are brain-oriented. You don't treat mental illness, which also has conditions of the brain that are involved. So we see that as an issue from a clinical standpoint that really doesn't make any sense. I guess the short way to say is you can't separate the mind and the body when you're talking about health care. So we would certainly hope that this committee, as it gets legislation, will look favorably on ending the discrimination that exists for a great number of people in this state.
Questions? Comments? Thank you. This is a start of our discussion. At this point, it'll be interesting to see what the mental health work group comes up with. I know there is a bill already submitted. There's another one I know that's in the works. And I think that Mr. McCauley did make a good point that some people are born with physical disorders and some are born with mental disorders, and yet we're not treating them equally. So the discussion is open. It will continue. And one more comment.
Senator
Courtney.
In the President's office apparently is given the option of having 10 bills that he or she can introduce and number them. Again, as it was last year, Senate Bill 1 will be mental health parity. So the first bill called Senate Bill 1 is mental health parity. So it'll be easy to identify.
Okay. That's good to know.
I mean, count to one.
Yeah. We'll remember that. You'll be hearing about that one a little later for sure. Any other comments? With that, meeting is adjourned.